Good morning. Well, what a week it has been. But just before 6 o'clock on Thursday, this.
Now, breaking news in just the last couple of minutes, RTE's crime correspondent Paul Reynolds is reporting that RTE News has learned that the organised cyber crime group that has attacked the HSE and the Department of Health systems has provided a decryption key. Now, that is a key that is now being checked by the commercial IT specialist company that was employed by the HSE, but there is some evidence at this point that it works. The decryption tool may be able to unlock the data that was disabled by the ransomware, but it won't be utilised on HSE systems until the IT specialists are certain that it does not contain any other malware or will not further damage the systems. And all of this is expected to take a few days because it will have to be first tested on virtual systems.
Dare we hope? Well, kind of. Yesterday, the decryption key was validated by the National Cybersecurity Agency, but described as flawed. Here's crime correspondent Paul Reynolds on the News at One.
They've established this to be a valid decryptor, a binary solution, which they validated by programming it into what's known as a sandbox. Now, a sandbox is a safe cyber environment in which they were able to open the key. The IT specialists were then able to use it within that safe environment on a sample of the HSE's encrypted data, and they discovered that the key worked. It decrypted the data. However, while they now have this algorithm, the decryption code, they need to build an engine in order to be able to use that code to unlock the corrupted HSE data. As one official put it to me, he says, look, we have the cargo, but we now have to build the truck to be able to transport it. Now, the criminal gang inserted a rolling encryption into the HSE systems to capture the data. But that rolling encryption also was pushed further down through the system, and it seems to be constantly changing or reiterating itself. So every time the IT specialists go into the system, they have to make sure they go in at the right point. They have to recommence at the exact same place. And they say this is a complicated procedure, which, if not done carefully enough, they could corrupt the data. They also have to undo some of the protections that they put into the systems to use this decryption key, a sort of a long string code. So, if you like, they have to reverse engines at this stage. They have to need sort of take one step back so that they can move five steps forward.
Golly, but that sounds complicated, but going in the right direction, fingers crossed. But why hack a system and then send a decryption key? Crisis of conscience for the Russian organised crime group nicknamed Wizard Spider, or something even more malicious? Well, just after the news broke on Thursday, Cormac got the reaction of Professor Ciarán Martin, founding chief executive of the National Cybersecurity Centre in the UK.
It is highly unusual for a decryption key to be provided if a ransom hasn't been paid. Of course, the government has maintained that it hasn't paid a ransom, and we should take that at face value. So why they would have done this is open to speculation. Ransomware works best when it's invisible, when people pay quietly. So the choice of a state healthcare system was somewhat unusual because it creates a national crisis in a glare of publicity. So it may be, just as we've seen with Colonial Pipelines in the US, where there's been some disruption and discontent amongst these various ransomware groups, that actually they're feeling a bit of heat. Mm-hmm. Because why on earth are they stopping people getting access to healthcare and so forth? So it may be that they've chosen to provide a decryption key for that reason.
On Morning Ireland yesterday, Áine spoke to Health Minister Stephen Donnelly.
The fact that a decryption key has been provided, I know the government has insisted no ransoms being paid, but people are wondering, you know, indirectly, even through third parties, because it's not usual that hackers would offer you the decryption tool out of the goodness of their hearts unless something was in it for them.
Yeah, and I can understand why that speculation would be there. I can tell you, Áine, and to your listeners, categorically, that no ransom has been paid by this government directly, indirectly, through any third party or in any other way, nor will any such ransom be paid.
So why did they give you the decryption tool yesterday?
It's unclear. It came as a surprise. We became aware yesterday afternoon that the key was being made available on a site which is linked to this criminal gang. Our technical group obviously then obtained that key and are currently testing it. And as I said, the the initial responses are positive, certainly the briefing, the latest briefing that I've had. As to why, there could be any number of reasons. It's probably not useful for me to speculate, but I think the main thing that people will want to hear and be absolutely assured on is that no ransom was paid, directly or indirectly, nor will any such ransom be paid.
And yesterday afternoon, we also learned that this was no accidental attack. No, this was a deliberate, targeted and ruthless cyber attack on a health system already under pressure in a pandemic. And all week long, we heard about the devastating effect it was having on hospitals and patients. On Tuesday, Claire spoke to Dr. Gabriel Colwyn, Vice President of the IHCA and Consultant Paediatric Radiologist.
How would you compare this, Gabriel, to the impact of the pandemic on all of you there?
Oh, well, for us in radiology, there really is no comparison. This is so much worse. At least during COVID, we had capacity restrictions, but we could still provide safe care to people. In the current situation, where we don't have access to prior imaging, prior reports, clinical information, and we're relying on verbally contacting people, what patients can share with us, it's just so much riskier. And it's the challenge of it really can't be overstated. You know, we would have children with ventriculoperitoneal shunts in situ, and if they come in with headaches, there's a clear question over, is it obstructed, is it blocked? And having been able to compare to the prior imaging to see if it's changed, that's a critical portion of work. So this is extremely challenging. This is the most challenging thing that has happened in the health service in the 19 years that I have been working in it.
Earlier on Morning Ireland, Amy Nearriadha spoke to people whose lives had been directly affected by this attack.
Viciously cross with whoever would have been responsible for this, because it's not affecting anyone, only the most vulnerable. The most vulnerable.
Jill Byrne's son, Cian, is 8 years of age and has Down syndrome. He had a major week of long-awaited appointments lined up.
On Thursday, he had an ophthalmology appointment to check for swelling in the back of his eyes. And on Friday morning, a long-awaited MRI scan to check for arthritis in his legs and ankles. And in the middle of that, he was going to have an echo in his heart and blood's done. There was a lot of things going to be done under this that needed to be done with a long time.
It's also been a long road for Donna Marie Cullen, who was on the home stretch of her cancer treatment when news of the cyber attack broke.
I have just completed 20 sessions of radiation, and my last 13 radiation sessions cannot go ahead due to the fact that radiation requires being online. And therefore, my treatment plan has just halted. I was due to finish on the 31st of May.
That finishing date now remains unknown, along with the consequences of delaying those appointments.
Well, for me, radiation is to obviously radiate the last possible cancer cells that I have. Without having radiation, it means that my cancer cells will just begin to multiply again. If people are in a worse scenario than me that haven't had the chance to have so much chemotherapy and surgery and at the beginning of the treatment, they're going to have their life in their hands, because people can't have the treatment that they need and that they desire.
From Morning Ireland. On Thursday, a new threat. The sale and publication of HSE data this Monday if a $20 million ransom demand was not met. Ryan Gallagher from Bloomberg News, who broke that story, joined Cormac on Drive Time.
The amount of data that you said the hackers said they had, is that quite sizable? 700 gigabytes of data. And what kind of information do they have, do they say?
Yeah, that's a massive amount of information. And you'd be what they claim that they have is like patient medical records, or procurement records, like internal sort of payroll information. I mean, all the kinds of stuff you would just expect, like hospitals and healthcare executive to store, not just about employees, but patients. So there'll be a massive trove in there of extremely sensitive information. And this is what they've been threatening to disclose. So, it's obviously very worrying for the authorities, but at the same time, they don't want to be paying the ransom, because the argument is that that encourages these groups. And that is the position of most governments, that they advise not paying.
But others had paid. How much and with what outcome?
We have the example in terms of whether to pay the ransom or not. Two examples, a Colonial Pipeline attack on the east coast of America, and also Scripps Health in San Diego. Yeah. Two different avenues there. What can you tell me about both?
Well, the Colonial case is interesting because they paid the ransom. This company is in the East Coast of America and runs a lot of the fuel across the East Coast of America. And they were a couple of weeks ago shut down by one of these ransomware incidents, very similar, forced to stop pumping their fuel. And they actually decided to pay a ransom of about $4.4 million just because they argued that basically they had no option because people need fuel and it was causing a crisis across the East Coast of America. So the FBI in the United States encourages that people, that organizations don't pay these ransoms, but in some situations, corporations are actually paying them huge sums. I mean, the largest reported one that we've heard of is about $40 million.
From Thursday's Drive Time, and our government is adamant it is not paying. And later that evening, the HSE secured an injunction against any publication of the stolen data. In fairness, not likely to worry our criminals too much, but perhaps an effective deterrent for others. And all week long, IT experts have been speaking on the airwaves. And all acknowledge that no system can be 100% secure. But questions began to be asked as to how something of this magnitude could have happened. On Tuesday's Morning Ireland, Rachel spoke to cybersecurity expert Brian Honan.
I'm looking at the impact on some hospitals on the HSE website, the one that you can still access. And I'm looking, it's University Hospital Limerick, and it says all outpatient clinics cancelled, all elective inpatient and day case procedures cancelled except time critical cases, all diagnostics including X-ray, CT scans, MRI appointments and cardiac investigations, endoscopy services also cancelled. Given the massive impact of something like this, was the HSE sufficiently prepared for this sort of attack?
Yeah, I think it's too early to judge that yet. We don't have the full details as to how the attack was launched and how these criminals bypassed the defence systems in the HSE. Again, these criminals are, you know, they're patient, they're well funded. They will take their time to break into a system, and there always will be some chink in the armour somewhere which eventually could get exploited. HSE has responded in the correct manner to this. I think it's very important to remember the HSE is a victim of a crime here. The people responsible for the crime are the criminals.
Well, on Monday, Clare spoke to Minister of State for Public Procurement and E-Government, Oisin Smith, and he spoke about the volume of attacks the HSE manages every week.
We would easily have 50 significant attacks a week which have to be reported and logged on. So with that, that's 2,500 attacks in the last year alone. And this is the one which is clearly beyond anything else that has ever come in. You know, it is an order of magnitude bigger than WannaCry. It's a completely different level of intrusion.
Okay, WannaCry was the one. Incident, this is the one that Tony O'Brien referred to, mm-hmm. the attack on the NHS, which cost them £100 million.
And the thing about WannaCry was it was not a group of people purposefully targeting that. It was just the standard virus that spreads around through emails that automatically switches from one machine to another. Whereas this is a criminal gang, particularly targeting different elements of the health service, the Department of Health, which is separate from the HSE, going in and then spending time investigating and particularly just aiming for a body that they knew was under stress at the moment, that would be focusing on the pandemic, that might have resources allocated away from the kind of routine security, and this is a targeted criminal attack of the worst kind.
And this gang were both patient and cunning.
Do you know how long these people, whoever these actors are, how long they were in the system before it was discovered late last week?
No, but we expect that they would have been in for some time. So the first thing they do when they get in is they start to look around the system and find what are the staff accounts, the login accounts from the HSE staff, who has the most privilege, can they compromise their passwords, how many different systems can they get onto. So they'll do that quietly for a while before they move to the next step, which is mm-hmm. trying to move data off the server, then try and attack the backups, then try and encrypt the server.
They may have been doing that for a couple of weeks, do you know?
It's possible.
Unbelievable. But was there an issue around the level of funding allocated to IT security, which may have led to our vulnerability? On the News at One on Tuesday, Health Minister Stephen Donnelly joined Brian.
Minister, the former Chief Information Officer of the HSE, Richard Corbridge, was on Morning Ireland this morning saying that there has been underinvestment in IT security within the organisation. We heard the former HSE boss Tony O'Brien saying yesterday that spending on cyber security is around a quarter of what it should be. Was the eye off the ball on this when it came to keeping our IT systems, our health IT systems, secure?
Certainly one thing we want to look at is the relevant spend. Is it possible that there was underinvestment? Maybe there was. Obviously, there are huge demands on healthcare spending to hire more staff, to buy in MRI machines and to do all of these things. What I can tell you is that the investment in IT has increased very, very significantly. So in 2019, it was about 130 million. This year, it's 203 million. And this year, I sanctioned nearly a doubling of ICT staff. So there were about 400 and we're adding 358 to that. So very, very significant investment has been going on for some time.
But not significant enough to allow the replacement, for example, of the Windows 7 operating system, which was an issue raised at the end of last year. Dr. Simon Woodworth from UCC was telling this programme that the pace of migration is pathetically slow and creates a single point of failure that could have massive consequences.
It's certainly something that we can take a look at, and we'll get a lot of good technical information from the firm that is doing the deep work on it at the
Sorry,
moment.
But Minister, this was last December. Why weren't you taking a look at it then?
Well, I've no doubt the HSE was, and the HSE has always taken cybersecurity very, very seriously. Remember, Brian, the HSE is the victim in this. There has been a very big increase in global attacks, specifically on healthcare systems. This one happened to get through.
It certainly did. Well, Claire spoke to Michael Murphy, former Army Lieutenant Colonel and Deputy Director of Military Intelligence and now a security consultant. And he felt that to some extent, we've all been sleepwalking when it comes to modern day cyber attacks.
Because we've had a naive and an incoherent response and a thought about security, that this is a chance for us to finally say, this is what can happen if we don't wake up to the threats, the new threats that are out there. In the past, maybe an army would have to invade. Today, that can be done from any part of the world. And they don't. They can take out your dams, where they can open up the dams and destroy cities. In fact, in Florida recently, they tried to poison water in the water system. Your power grid could be taken out, so they could put you back to the medieval times.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a wake-up call. Now
we're wide awake now, I can tell you. And a little scared. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Eurovision. Why, oh why, does it mean so much to us? Maybe because once upon a time, we romped home with just three chords and a twinkle in our eye. Johnny in the white suit. So, the History Show went back to 1990, the year when the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia hosted the competition. The Berlin Wall lay in rubble, the European Community, as it was then called, was gathering apace. And as Martina Relihan reminded us, the songs reflected more than just a, oh, baby, baby.
Norway presented the Brandenburg Gate, but it flopped, finishing last. Austria's variation on a theme, No More Walls, fared better. And Germany's Free to Live finished ninth. All three were seriously outdone by Ireland's masterclass in Eurovision Song Contest diplomacy somewhere in Europe. The song, delivered by the late Liam Riley, seated at the piano in his moss-green jacket and tie, was all things to all Europeans, and it went down a treat with the juries, finishing a close second. I remember Amsterdam as we
were walking in old Brussels.
The night belonged to Italy, however, and their white-suited singer Toto with the song NCMA Together 1992. The date a reference to the forthcoming Maastricht Treaty, which ushered in the European Union.
NCMA, unite, unite, you're all.
Even if your Italian wasn't up to translating lyrics such as Europe is not far away, this is Italian song for you. We are more and more free, our stars, one single flag, stronger and stronger. Toto belted home the core message in the plainest of English. Arms stretched wide, eyes closed, and with hands clasped together for a final soulful Europe.
Unite, unite, Europe.
Oh, magnificent. Back when Ireland was Eurovision. This year we sent Leslie Roy with her song Maps, but it was not to be. Here's the semi-final countdown with Spíček Zelinský and Neil Doherty gripping the spandex.
There's
one place left. So we're crossing everything for Leslie Roy in Ireland.
Well, what else can they do now?
How much can they build the tension now? How long can they delay this?
Spot. Left. This is really tense. Who's coming back this Saturday for the grand final? The 10th finalist is Ukraine!
Ukraine, yeah, well done. What's another year and all that, so no Ireland in the Eurovision for 2021. So be it, you might think. However, on Wednesday, Liveline callers wanted their say. Now most praised the singing of our Leslie Roy and her athleticism, because was she on a treadmill?
Well, if I said two kitchen rolls, a black pen and two sheets of grey curd, that's what the display was last night. The girl
Say that again, Mary.
If you were looking at what we were presented with, it was like when she was running, there was a toilet roll either side or a kitchen roll either side of her, going around and around with little drawings on it that a 4 or 5 year old could have done.
Yeah.
And then the forest was two sheets of grey card that were cut out with a scissors. And she was so busy, God help her, trying to remember what to swat or what not to swat and running, that if they had just gotten rid of all that rubbish and let the girl come out on stage and do what she does best, which is belt the song out, because the last 30 seconds, Joe, she was amazing.
I think the production was poor. To me, the vocals weren't great on the night, and the production was very poor. It was like some sort of cartoon from Czechoslovakia from the 1960s.
What are you saying? Lolek and Bolek?
Yeah, I just, you know, I like the song. This is the sad part about it, song. But I just thought that production was all wrong, and unfortunately, whatever happened, Leslie's vocal, I think, wasn't as strong as it should have been, as much in all as I wanted it to do well.
You thought Leslie was brilliant?
I thought she did a terrific job. I don't know her from Adam, but she looked as if she was trying to get out of a jungle and kind of try and keep hold a note at the same time. I thought that was ridiculous. I thought she was a lovely girl, and I think it's a bit of a misnomer now at this stage to be calling it a song contest. It looked, the Israeli one, and there was another one as well, it looked more like a soft porn show to me. You'd be too busy looking or listening to the song.
And what do you mean? What do you mean, soft porn?
The way they were dressed and everything. You know what I mean? Like it's supposed to be. I know you can have a show and make it. And what these fella?
What do you mean, low cut and tight and short?
And the suspender belt and all that kind of thing.
That was the fellas. What about the women?
Enter then, in a haze of dry ice, former RTE Eurovision maestro, Julian Vignoles.
Maybe some of our more established singers should step up to the plate, step up to the challenge of going to Europe. I mean, it is risky. You go along and you do your best, and maybe it doesn't go right. You end up down the pecking order, but that's what you need. And I mean, if you looked, anyone who saw last night, I mean, you can argue the toss on you know, the stage of various songs. But, I mean, there were some mighty singers there last night.
But Julian, given that we have so many, like, internationally popular young bands, well, youngish bands, I'm thinking of Codeline, the Groaners, I'm thinking of Fontaines D.C., I'm thinking of Gavin James, I'm thinking of Dear McKenna, the list goes on and on and on. The Pillow Queens, Roisin O.
But if all those, any of those people wanted or thought they could do well in the Eurovision Song Contest, they would have made themselves known to RTE.
Okay, well, and is it too risky for them, is it?
As a lover of the contest myself, I think they should try it. But, I mean, I can see that it is risky.
Are you saying that there are some more established bands, some of them should step forward and say, I am willing, almost as an act of patriotism, I'm willing to represent Ireland?
But I think they should. And if you want to see the tricolour in a green room in Azerbaijan or Rostam flying when you've done well, you need acts that are very experienced.
So, experienced, well-known acts. Does any of that explain what happened in 2008? The moment for many that we burnt it all to the ground in a Celtic Tiger fit of hubris. With this,
I just think, like, we completely burn our bridges ever since we sent a turkey in a box screaming 12 points at everyone. I just think it was, you know, two fingers up to Europe. I think since then we're hiding to nothing.
Also on the line was Ken O'Sullivan, former chairman of the Irish jury for the Eurovision in 2016.
What a self-respecting artist is going to compose a song and spend time, effort, money, the whole lot, in actually sending in a song knowing that they're going to finish second to a stuffed turkey.
And who can follow that? Well, here is Julian with the turkey defence.
Remember that Dustin was picked by the public first? And the next thing to remember is that there wasn't a critical word written in any newspaper about Dustin that year. It was people criticised the contest and they criticised this and that. The whole country was behind Dustin. In retrospect, it was a bad idea. The joke didn't travel. Mm-hmm. Dustin couldn't sing very well and he was surrounded by good singers.
A bad idea? A bad singer? Is that the sound of Dustin scratching a solicitor's letter? Luckily, Ray Darcy offered right of reply.
Europe, where did it all go wrong? Dustin.
Where did it all go wrong? It is. I still have the shopping trolley. It only cost me €2 now. That's mad. Look, asking Johnny Logan and Dana to fix the Eurovision is like asking Beethoven to fix the X Factor. You know, it's 50 or 60. I think Johnny Logan won it in, I think it was 1890. And there was only three countries in it. There was Wyoming, France, and Roscommon. I mean, like, it's just barking mad. By the way, look, fair play to Leslie last night. I thought she's absolutely brilliant. I genuinely did. I thought she should have got through.
Yeah.
But then, like, six countries don't. And that's just the way it works. The cookie crumbles. The cookie crumbles, as they say.
Yeah, you represented Ireland.
I come from a nation. I still got it, Rael. I still got it. Yeah. I've got... Book the ticket. Right, it's what Pearson Hanley fought and died for. It's the best crack you're ever going to have in your life, going to the Eurovision. But if you're not nervous, there's something wrong with you. I think I laid an egg in my shopping trolley. I was so nervous. But I hope it was an egg. But it was just, like, I mean, I was the one who said, you know, Eastern Europe, we love you. Do you like Irish Jew or goulash, as it is to you? And I didn't get through on that. So what hope does anyone else have? If I curse this fair play, I've saved the country a fortune.
Oh, I come from a nation what knows how to write a song. Oh, Europe, where, oh, where did it all go wrong? Come on!
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Valeria Lucelle is this year's winner of the Dublin Literary Award, and with that, a prize of a cool €100,000. Her book is called Lost Children Archive, and it tells the story of a family on a road trip across America as they listen to news of thousands of children being detained at their country's border. Lucelle spoke to Kay Sheehy on Arena And turns out she's a massive radio fan. And this feeds into her novel.
I am I'm a radio junkie. I like to travel mostly by road. So whenever I'm crossing any landscape, I look for the radio stations, the local radio stations, sometimes just to listen to languages that I don't know, and to listen to voices and stories and music. I think the radio is, for me, the most fascinating medium. And the narrator in the story, her husband is a sound documentarist. So the novel itself is a novel that kind of collects sounds. In writing it, I had to think a lot about the archive, right? And what we put together in a single archive. So the novel both discusses an archive, but is also its own archive. There's kind of interstitial chapters in there called boxes. And those boxes are indeed boxes that travel with the family in the trunk of the car, containing the material that the two adults in the story are using in order to work on their projects. But those boxes are also opened as chapters, and readers can kind of peer into those boxes and see what they contain. And somehow, in looking at what they contain, what they're looking at is the kind of skeleton, the very raw material as well that makes up this particular novel, Lost Children Archive.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. That was Valeria Lucelle on Arena, this year's winner of the Dublin Literary Award. Aoife O'Donoghue had a midlife career change, but how it had come about was pretty profound.
Lampshades.
Yes.
This is your stock in trade.
It is indeed, yes. It's an idea that came to me back in 2015.
Yeah.
I was working in the bank at the time, and I was doing up my sitting room, and I had these fabulous curtains, and I just wanted a pink lampshade, and I could not find one.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, there's a bit of an opening here. But as I was working in the bank, I couldn't, you know, look at doing a business, leaving a business. I was a single parent with two children, and doing a safe job, needed to stay there. But I actually became ill in 2016 with a condition called transverse myelitis, which left me paralysed from my neck down initially. But I did manage to get my arm back.
What age were you when that?
38. I got a virus, and my immune system fought the virus. And whilst it was fighting the virus, it also attacked my spinal cord.
No.
So slowly but surely, I kind of lost power in my legs and it was moving up my body. So it took a few days for them to diagnose it in the hospital, but I was paralysed to my neck. And when they diagnosed it, then I was given treatment and I managed to get my arms back, but I've been left permanently paralysed from my chest down.
What is it like, if you don't mind me asking, when you're 38 years old and you're told you're paralysed from the neck down? How do you respond to that? Or?
If I had been told a year earlier this was going to happen to me, I would have said I would never cope with it.
Yeah.
And it's just when you're in the situation, I think you just take one day at a time and, you know, I don't know where the strength came from, but it came from somewhere. And I was just focused and I was kind of like, if I get my arms back, at least if I get my arms back, I'll be very grateful for that. And thankfully I did. But unfortunately, I won't get the use of my legs back. It's not going to happen at this stage. Basically, I spent 6 years between University Hospital Galway, Dunleary. My house had to be completely gutted to suit the wheelchair. Moved back, had to live with my parents, but my children, myself, the two dogs all moved in with my parents.
Okay.
Renovated the house, moved back in home. And then I was kind of like, I need to be doing something. Every day was the same. You know, there was days I wouldn't even get out of bed. And I kind of like, the lampshades. Because actually, the day I walked out of my house, the last day I walked, there was a lampshade, a glue gun and fabric left on the table.
Really?
And I was like, okay, I think this is a sign.
That is an incredibly impressive attitude. But it wasn't always thus.
What keeps you so in good form? I'm sure you're not in good form every day like all of us, but what keeps you in fairly good form?
My perspective completely changed. Before I ended up paralysed, I was actually quite a negative person and I used to look at what I didn't have.
Really?
And for some reason then, I know, I would actually say I'm a happier person now than what I was beforehand. Now I look at what I do have and I focus on what I have and not what I don't have. You know,
so
there was days even I was upset one day and Austin says to me, do you know, Mum, you could have actually, you know, you could have died, but you're here, you know, and you know, our family. And so I focus on what I have. And when you go through a situation like that, you really see how wonderful your family network and friends are, you know. So I'm very fortunate.
Admirable on all kinds of levels. That was Aoife O'Donoghue with Ryan. Life in Ireland by Conor W. O'Brien takes a look at all the various creepy crawlies and creatures that used to call this island home. He spoke to Ray.
We've had so many different creatures here. I mean, we've had dinosaurs, we've had ichthyosaurs. So dinosaurs kind of get the bulk of the press when you think about ancient reptiles. You know, you think about, you know, dinosaurs, obviously. But there were equally impressive reptiles that lived at the same time but just lived in the oceans, and they left some of their fossils in Ireland as well. So a very famous group are called the ichthyosaurs. They would have looked a lot like dolphins would have today. They would have had a dorsal fin on their back, would have been had a very similar shape with a long beak, massive eyes for seeing their prey in the water. Yeah. They probably would have lived fairly similarly to dolphins as well. Now, they wouldn't have been able to detect their prey using sound the way that dolphins do, but they would have pursued their prey with a lot of speed through the water. Then we also had plesiosaurs in Ireland. Now, when people think of plesiosaurs, they think of kind of the classic Loch Ness monster with the really long neck and the small head and the four flippers kind of coming off of a small body. Plesiosaurs did exist. The Loch Ness monster, I'm not so sure about, but we did definitely have plesiosaurs in Ireland about 200 million years ago.
Now, before the dinosaurs, the amphibians sort of ruled the world.
That's true.
Now, they're a sort of mishmash, raggle-taggle group, aren't they? They were some of the most wonderful, weird, ugly-looking creatures.
Absolutely. Well, basically, so about 300 million years ago, or a little bit before that, we had what in Ireland what are called coal forests. So the remains of that have been preserved in places like Castlecomer and County Kilkenny. And so in these coal forests, that we would have had a really weird cast of amphibians, including forms that would have looked a lot like snakes and crocodiles and even lizards. They wouldn't have been, obviously, snakes, crocodiles and lizards, because those creatures had yet to evolve. But before them, there were amphibians that would have filled the same roles as those creatures. So they evolved to look very similar. So incredible stuff, really.
Absolutely. However, there are some creatures we do not want. And if you've been ordering bits and bobs online and you've been getting packages and parcels from Asian countries, listen up. You might have a stowaway, the Asian hornet. Here's Aina on Mooney Goes Wild.
This Asian hornet was actually found in a house in North County Dublin, and the person who saw it knew it wasn't an ordinary jumped up wasp on steroids, took a picture of it and sent it in to the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and it was actually identified properly. So this hornet, of course, is a huge thing relative. It's a wasp, essentially. It's a wasp. And wasps in Ireland, or ordinary old wasps, are about 17, 18 millimetres in length, whereas the worker wasp of this is about 25 millimetres long, which in old money is an inch. And then you have the queens then, which are over 30 millimetres long. And that's fine. What's wrong with that? Why can't we have other wasps? So the reason why we can't, why we're terrified in a way, is because this particular hornet feeds on honeybees, and it can really do a huge amount of damage to the honeybee population. We have the poor honeybees haven't enough to be putting up with without this. And what these particular hornets do, and they're the only species that do it, is they hang around outside honeybee hives. They wait for the honeybees to come home. They grab them in the air, bite the head off them and suck the guts and middles and beautiful stuff out of the middle of them and bring it off to feed their young with. And because a complete nest of hornets could have up to thousands of workers in it, they can do a huge great deal of depredation. It's got an orange face. It's completely black with a yellow third last segment, and its legs are black on top, and it has yellow bottoms to the legs, whereas ordinary wasps have completely yellow legs. But this one has, if you like, black thighs, Derek, and yellow calves, if such a thing could be described in hornet's legs.
I think you just did, Inna. But these hornets are far from the sunshine, and what makes us cranky and bemoan our lot, rain basically, is an environment that will kill this insect. So
we don't really want to pray for a wet summer, but if we do have a wet summer, at least that'll be a silver lining, if you like, because it won't be suitable for the Asian hornet.
Hush now, missus. We might take our chances. Because unsettled has been the outlook for much of the week. Thunder, lightning, rain, cold. What is going on? Meteorologist Liz Walsh joined Claire on a wet Thursday in the capital with an explanation of the difference between our low pressure Boo Hiss and high pressure Blue Skies.
Well, low pressure on a map, like it can differ, but a lot of the time you'll see these circles that are tightly wound around each other. And then high pressure, the lines are further apart. They're called isobars. Mm-hmm. So it's lines of constant pressure. So with a high pressure, you're kind of looking at a lot of dry and settled weather. And that's because high pressure has basically there's enormous pressure. It's kind of, if we think about it, like from physics, right? Pressure is the weight of the air above us. OK, so a high pressure would be kind of like a heavy thing. It's under enormous pressure. So like it's kind of weighing down on you. And if you think about it, the air in a high pressure, what's it doing? If it's heavy, it's squeezing out all the moisture above us. So it's like, you know, it's got this pressing down. So it can't really form clouds. So mm-hmm. you can't really get rain. Whereas low pressure is different. So what's happening is it's kind of lighter air. So lighter air is able to rise. And so you're getting a lot of vertical motion. But what happens when you kind of lift air from the surface and you're going up through the atmosphere? It's colder up at the top of the atmosphere. So what happens is it's condensing into clouds and rain. And so you're getting basically just the low pressure is able to move faster than a high pressure. And
so is that what we have today then?
Yes.
Low pressure.
Yeah.
Which is all the squalling around and everything is
vertical motion.
The wind and the rain and everything and the horrible.
Ooh, yes. The general horrible. And we also heard from physicist from UCD's School of Education, Shane Bergen, who'd been out with his measuring tape.
The largest raindrop you can get is about 6 millimetres wide, right? And that comes in a thundercloud. Normally in Ireland, we get much smaller rain. The rain out there today is nothing close to 6 mils wide. But you can get huge raindrops and they form in the storm clouds. And those storm clouds can be kilometres high into the atmosphere. They can come with thunder and lightning that many people have experienced in the last few days. And the raindrops have to fall so much further that they accumulate with other raindrops to form into these whoppers that can kill your plants.
Because we're used to we're used to the fine rain here, aren't we?
Absolutely. The fine day, the misty day that comes in off the ocean. But you know what? This is probably going to result in me needing a Garda escort home. I think we have the perfect weather conditions in Ireland. It's not too hot, it's not too cold. Things grow here virtually all year long. Whilst maybe France or Italy have the kind of slight edge on us in terms of the heat and the sunny days, we really do have very, very good weather here.
Says the man who gets his kicks from measuring raindrops. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Buckets of rain, buckets of tears, got all them buckets coming out of my ears, buckets of moonbeams in my hand. You got all the love, honey, baby, I